Hello, everyone. This is More Podcast, Less Process. I'm Jefferson Bailey at Metropolitan New York Library Council. And my co-host is...
Josh.
Josh Ranger.
That's not how we practiced it.
Wait, how did we practice it? I don't remember. We only practiced it once. All right, so the reason for our podcast here is we get a grant from the New York State Archive as part of the Documentary Heritage Program, which we roll into our Keeping Collections project, which provides services to local nonprofit institutions collecting historical material in New York City, in the New York City region.
Westchester County.
Yep, meaning Westchester County. So our Archives podcast is a chance for us to talk to people from around New York doing interesting projects, working in interesting institutions with good collections, are just smart archivists in general. So talking to us conversationally around sort of specific or broad topics, depending on how we frame them that week. So thanks to New York State Archives for funding it. This is obviously our first version of this podcast.
Oh, version.
Yes, version.
Not iteration.
Yes, also our first iteration. So it's going to be a pretty DIY affair, or DYI, depending, or DPI, maybe that's more appropriate. So there will be background noise because we're in New York City, and obviously there will be heavy editing.
Yes, and it's summer. And it's hot.
Yep.
And there's air conditioning.
Air conditioning is important. So that's the intro. So I'm going to have our guests this week introduce themselves. So,
hi, I'm Don Menarek from the New York Public Library, digital archivist.
And I'm Mark Modienzo. I'm a digital archivist at Manuscripts and Archives at the Yale University Library. And I'm also the technical architect of the Archive Space Project.
Awesome.
That's great. And in case you didn't notice, our topic this week is digital focused, and we're going to be talking about digital forensics specifically with Don and Mark. And, you know, I guess just to start out, you know, I know forensics is not like CSI when we're talking about it here. Judging from your sunglasses, it's probably more like CSI Miami, I bet. But that's another issue. So
what about all the pastels I'm wearing?
Is that true?
I'm more of Miami Vice vibe than CSI Miami.
Yeah. Well, you're an archivist, so you know, yeah, you're kind of pulling from all different eras and, yeah, referencing back in time.
I have Crockett's theme playing in the background wherever I go.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of listening to Jan Hammer when you're doing forensics work, I imagine.
Actually, that's kind of true. That's, yeah, how Don and I first bonded when we were both still at Yale.
Yeah, and you have a jet boat up there too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Runs along the Long Island Sound. That's how we get back to New York.
Yes.
No, so, Metro North here.
So I guess just to start generally, I mean, this term is really exploded recently, digital forensics. Like, everybody's talking about it now. You know, like, I was down at the corner store and they were talking to me about it. So I'm not sure that they knew what it meant exactly.
Bodega forensics.
Yeah. It maybe had more to do with CSI. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to get a general sense that, you know, just broadly, what are we talking about here? What is digital forensics?
So generally the use of the word forensics usually means the use of scientific method to ascertain facts about things. So in this case, we're using tools that forensic investigators, investigating crimes would use to understand media that's given to us. So we're looking to understand how things were created, why they're created, and why ultimately they ended up in our collections. So it's a whole range of tools and methods that are kind of implicated when we use the term digital forensics in archives, but essentially it's just trying to get a better understanding of why things are where they are now so that archivists can try to make sense out of them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting to me, because my general sense, or what I have thought about before, is it's like about creating access, but what you're talking about is also kind of, where does this come from? Why is it here? Is this whole uncovering of what the thing is? That's not just how do we make this accessible to somebody, but a much deeper thing there.
Right. Yeah. I think a big part of it is So thinking about it from, you know, the framework of law enforcement and the legal profession, I mean, digital forensics or any sort of forensic discipline in particular is really focuses on the acquisition of evidence. I forget the name of the exact framework, but there's a framework for digital investigations that was developed, and so there are actually these multiple phases in this framework. And when you look at this framework specifically for sort of the process of acquiring evidence, or you know, acquiring a piece of you know. Both, you know, at the level of taking it from a crime scene and then doing, you know, essentially putting it through the process, like the processes that we've adapted in our institutions, it looks very similar to a digital preservation workflow or an archival processing workflow. So there's, from the standpoint of digital forensics, one of the most important things is you don't want to modify anything. Or you want to essentially capture as much information before you go through the process. You need to document everything. You need to, you know, ensure that you're not accidentally introducing any changes. If you do introduce a change, you need to do it in a way which is ultimately repeatable or sort of cordon off a particular, you know, part of that. And that really speaks to the need within archives to maintain the authenticity of the information that we're responsible for. I also think that you start to see this workflow. You know, it focuses around preservation of evidence and then doing some degree of processing or extraction, and then basically being able to report out on what this investigation uncovered. The major difference that I see is, the way it appears to me is that with digital forensics, if you're actually doing some sort of investigation, you're focused on a specific piece of evidence or a specific set of evidence. When archivists adapt digital forensics techniques and methodologies, we're not after a single piece of evidence in the same way. You know, we're more incorporating it, you know, into an arsenal of techniques that, that we use to preserve and process information. So in some ways, the goals end up being a little bit different. And so I think one of the things that we've found is that a lot of the tools, the tools that we use for digital forensics work well up to a point, and then they start to get, they start to not fall apart, but they're not designed for the type of work that we do necessarily.
Yeah, and I guess like a case of that would be, the reporting that you get out of any forensic suite, which is really good for, making a report that you're giving to a court, but doesn't really jive well with bibliographic systems or things that we're using in libraries. So I think that's one of the main ones that we run into where it just, it kind of splits. Like a forensic suite generally is not designed to integrate with library systems. So
they haven't made any EAD for those yet.
No. That would be great, but no. Actually, essentially the way that we're working at NYPL right now is that we're more or less mocking up what our EAD looks like or the skeleton of it in the forensic suite, and then we have to do a ton of work to try to actually get that out and over and into an actual EAD file. So yeah, there definitely are limits that you run into that become rather painful to deal with rather quickly. But on the side of doing the kind of preservation actions or your any of your basic acquisition stuff, it really excels, or even analysis, the types of analysis that you can do with a tool like Forensic Toolkit is pretty amazing when you compare it to how we deal with paper files. Currently, what you can learn about the collection is pretty mind-blowing sometimes if you haven't used those types of tools before.
Mm-hmm. So I was struck by something you said that was just the connection to conservation, I think, just the idea of, not introducing the changes and making things reversible. So think about that in the much more in like the art conservation sense. And in dealing with audiovisual stuff, you know, we try to do that, but we also understand there's a degree of generation loss or change when you're reformatting. You know, you have to reformat, and it's always going to change it in some manner. You're just trying to stay as close to the original as you can. From one perspective, when we think about like digital, like it's ones and zeros and it's perfect and there's not that
shimmery fluid.
But is there, you know, where does that change come in? Like, how precious can you be?
I think it's our obligation to keep it as close to the original. No, we have to keep things in the original form as possible. So actually, audio is an interesting analog because, you know, depending on what type of format of audio you're dealing with, you're kind of dealing with like the same basic idea. Like, you have a domain and there's a frequency in that domain, and you're measuring that, you know, however many times it's been sampled. But with the file formats that we're dealing with, it's like usually we have no understanding of how that file was meant to use, like what that byte stream means, which makes it actually really difficult to work with. We can't take it for granted that we know how we're going to migrate something, or that we can, you know, make that version that we can work with. It's always struck me as a really complicated problem to deal with, especially when you, like, I don't know, we took in a CD from an organization and it had, you know, 10,000 different files on it, and they weren't documented really well, and we didn't know what types of file formats the work that goes into understanding those can become particularly problematic, especially if it's older materials where, you know, file formats from the 80s, there's just not good documentation about them or how to use them or how to get the software to run those. Last week I was working with a collection of word processing files that were, of course, like every word processing file had a .doc extension. But it turned out they were the advanced multimate format, which I was completely unfamiliar with, and it took some time to figure out what we were going to do with them. So, there's a level of, like, you can't take anything for granted, usually with the collections that were, the legacy collections that we're dealing with.
Yeah, I think that's, in some ways, it's kind of a bad legacy that you know, we've kind of got a raw deal. I admit a strong degree of frustration about this. I've seen a number of collections where, you know, essentially because we took in all the paper, we got, you know, some, like, you know, cache of discs, you know, just a bunch of discs in a box. And, you know, sort of abstractly as archivists, you know, we've been told that we've got this obligation to this material, but, from time to time, you know, I've definitely seen some collections, in my experience, where really some better appraisal decisions up front would have just not even necessarily knowing what the contents of every disc were, but maybe at least knowing, you know, that, you know, we, you know, knowing that these are really end up being just working drafts, which are not really understood to be important. The final product is what's important. You know, these discs contain restricted material that we're not going to be able to provide access to for 75 years. Then, you know, why are we putting the effort into making this information available or preserving it? You know, there's the problem that I see, and I'm starting to see it, you know, sort of throughout, you know, the profession, is now that sort of electronic records are not a new problem for archives. But they seem to keep getting reinvented, and it keeps getting sort of pushed along and saying, well, you know, it's not our problem in this way. And I think there are definitely some institutions that have been taking a more holistic approach, but really, you know, it requires some hard decisions about the content you already have and whether it's actually worth it to put the level of energy that it takes to, you know, extract content from a disc from 1982. You know, is that, you know, I think we've been sort of enamored by a lot of popular stories of, you know, recovering, the original source code of Prince of Persia, which, you know, that's obviously important, but that's not everything that we have. And certainly, I don't think, you know, not every institution has collections that are really going to be worth that level of attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like, I mean, it's definitely speaking to the point that a lot of the forensics work seems very much institutionally dependent as far as like how integrated it can be with existing workflows, like how detailed it can be, what level of training and equipment purchasing even is realistic for a lot of places. I mean, I know there's been like recent reports trying to get people to at least address it more actively and, you know, at least get it out of boxes and off of legacy media. But I guess, like, what would you guys say to smaller institutions that are looking, are just general practitioners that, I mean, I guess where do we see it going as far as like developing workflows that are flexible enough to be implemented, you know, however broad that might be, at different institutions? Because right now it seems very dependent on collections and resources.
That's a really difficult question. I personally wouldn't have advice for a small institution now that we've been doing this for a couple of years, other than, I don't know. I mean, like, I think the promise of what BitCurator is going to bring is probably the tool that they're thinking about that problem specifically, about what are the tools, what are the software, even, you know, they're thinking about the hardware as well, of to do this sort of, I don't know if you want to call it like basic triage and processing or acquisition of materials. I guess my suggestion would be to wait to see how BitCurator, because it can be a daunting program to try to establish. It's not just buying equipment. There's, you know, I mean, I think both of us would say the same thing, like, you know, beyond anything that you can just purchase off the shelf, the tools, you know, buy a Cryoflux or whatever, there's still a lot of work you have to deal with on yourself of actually like pushing bits around, and that's not necessarily easy. And I would say that you're not necessarily going to get support from your IT department to deal with.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
So, like, I mean, I guess if you have the dedicated staffing that's just going to grind away at the problems, that's what it feels like sometimes you're doing.
I think if, you know, for any institution, just not just small institutions, but for any institution who's thinking about this, you know, I would say if you're worried about media acquisition workflows, you're kind of worried about the wrong part of the problem. I mean, I acknowledge that it's complicated. I acknowledge that it is potentially expensive. It requires specialized knowledge. That's precisely why I think a lot of institutions should not be worried about it. I think we do have a strong enough community of practice where I'm really hoping that some sort of business model to deal with obsolete media in particular will come about and operate at a scale where it's cost effective for, you know, institutions to ship out their media, you know. But I think if you're really concerned about digital material, obviously getting some control of what you have already is really useful. But I think what's more important is thinking about what you're collecting and why you're collecting it. I think one of the things that I really urge people to consider is, you know, what's going to happen when you're done with this stuff. You know, you're still sort of pushing back the problem and saying, you know, if you're in an institution that does any sort of active collecting, you really need to be thinking about what you're collecting and why you're collecting it. And I think at this point, it really makes more sense for an institution to worry about, you know, unless they're facing, you know, sort of what some of us have been facing, which are really like hundreds and hundreds of boxes of disks. Think about what you're collecting. Think about, you know, from the last 5 years, you know, especially since since the advent of, you know, social media and cloud computing, like what actually is the most important thing to capture right now. You know, if you're working with organizational records, you know, focus on, you know, focus on content and context. Don't focus on the technical part of the problem. I mean, it's easy for a technologist like me to say that the technical parts will be solved, but in many cases, the technical parts already are solved. They're just not necessarily solved at scale. And these are hard problems, but, you know, think like an archivist, you know, focus on really, you know, what's the stuff, you know, what are the records that you should be trying to obtain now?
I mean, that makes me think of something you were mentioning before too, that I wanted to bring back up, about the idea of the working copy stuff. And this is something I've been wondering about for a while, because we run into this of that there's during a movie production or video, you know, audio production, whatever it is, there are series of, you know, as that's being created, they're creating different pieces, versions of it that aren't the finished piece. They're not even necessarily like a good piece. And comparing that to traditional manuscript archives, and where, you know, where the manuscript, the original like handwritten piece of paper, is like, well, this is this great thing, you know, it's got all this spirit in it, and
aura, yes.
Yeah, so yeah, it's got the aura, and it's, yeah, and we can investigate it to find out like what the original intent was, yeah, and how they changed things, and you know, I always wonder like what that role is in a audio visual production, and you know, where does that lie in the digital world? Like are all those diskettes that are full of different versions of a Word document, is that a worthwhile thing in the same way that we would think of in the same way, or now with, you know, cloud computing stuff, where it's you know, a little bit harder to track, at least in that same way, of how things are being updated. Like where does that lie?
Yeah, it's difficult. So like one of the collections we're working with right now, the Timothy Leary records, he was working in software development in the late 80s or funding it. It's not really totally clear to me the situation, but we literally have different working versions of software that are scattered across disks throughout the collection to kind of try to make that picture without being involved with how those records ultimately got stored, because they were handed through different organizations over the last two decades. That becomes really, really problematic, especially with somebody like Larry, who was always changing the names of his projects too, and it all just becomes one big digital blur of bits and stuff that we don't know how to deal with. And I guess to compound that, the way that I've been thinking about things is breaking things into two different classes. You have this class of a, you know, like a disk that has files on it. And while those files might be related to each other, they don't require each other to render something, versus a disk where you have things that need to work with each other, like, I don't know, a Clarion database, where we have the database application and the data files, and all those parts need to work together. And sometimes they're on one disk, or sometimes they're on two, where you have to kind of think about, you know, I guess, again, we're talking about like what the context of this thing is, and kind of separating those into different classes has made it a little easier for us to approach those types of problems, to say like, well, we know he was working with a word processor and these disks are kind of his disks that he was using for a processor, but these other things are, you know, from software development projects that people were sending him, and those are, you know, you have to interact with them in a completely different way, sometimes in a way that are, you know, your forensic tools aren't even designed to work with. I don't know if I answered that.
But that's great. Yeah.
Yeah, it's complex, and I guess I don't have a great answer.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would answer it a different way, which is, I think some digital material, you know, that perspective is really important. I think it's important based on what discipline you're coming from. You know, obviously you hear a lot more about that in terms of understanding digital material, or particularly understanding literary material. But, you know, it's really hard to make that into a blanket decision, you know, or to policy about how you handle all your material. I mean, I think there are certain repositories which certainly have the ability to do that because of their collecting scope and because of their budget. But, you know, realistically, for the types of records that I've worked with, you know, is somebody really going to be concerned about the aura of university records? I mean, somebody certainly could be, but that would, you know, require a significant, you know, contribution to change our university archives.
Not to denigrate records management.
No, not at all.
Every newsletter is important.
but you know, I think it requires, you know, it requires to make us to make some, either some assumptions or to, you know, go back to sort of how we started this conversation, you know, trying to figure out what we can, what evidence we can actually derive from, these material, you know, that evidence that goes beyond sort of, you know, from the perspective of an archivist, you know, beyond the what the records actually stand for. So, I mean, and again, it's sort of this can easily become a slippery slope. It can, you can put a lot of time and effort into exploring these without really having a lot to show for it. So for example, you know, when I was working with one collection in particular, I was able to ascertain by, you know, through a series of factors that, you know, it was like a group of 27 discs. And I think from an artifactual perspective, the discs weren't terribly valuable. They were used as transfer media for this person to move records from their office computer to their work computer, or their computer that they used in their cottage where he went for the summer. You know, the arrangement of the files on the discs were, you know, it seemed to be whichever had the most amount of space at the time. You know, oftentimes when we bring in records from organizations, they'll either give them to us on CDs or DVDs or external hard drives, but those are transfer media. There is nothing inherently valuable about the media, but we know that because, you know, because that's the interaction we've had, but we haven't really found a good way to document it. I mean, at least for the way that we tend to operate in my repository, the records are what's important. The media itself is less important. But again, that largely has to do with what we've collected and how it's been collected so far.
So what do you do with that media? What happens at the point when you have some diskettes or some floppy disks and you get the files off, you get what you need off, you've done whatever emulation or whatever it is that you've done. Do you keep that media?
At this point, we still keep the media. I mean, it's mostly it's kind of like a odd insurance policy, but you know, we don't have the policy in place to be able to get rid of it. But so we're retaining it for the time being.
Yeah, our stuff is just going into cold storage because we're not sure what to do with it.
Uh-huh. It's what we face with audiovisual stuff as well. Like at some point the media will not be playable, but there's a question, do we get rid of it or mm-hmm. hold on and wait and see, maybe something will happen. Who knows? So.
Well, it's interesting that the media does itself pose some challenges as far as like file structure and things. So even though it is just a transfer object, it still, as far as forensics works, seems to have a large impact on at least recovery, certainly not its use as, you know, storage originally. But
so I guess we can kind of maybe turn it around just to talk about what you actually do, like in your jobs, and if we think about the what archives typically do, the different pieces of you know, things being acquired, appraised, processed, you know, creating access. Do your roles as digital archivists, like, does it fit into that same kind of workflow? Is there a difference there in what you're doing and in implementing forensics into that and how you're doing things?
Yeah, I guess how involved are you in the appraisal process? Are digital archivists generally?
Well, I guess NYPL, we're, I guess, kind of lucky that we have a number of archivists that are enthusiasts about working with the material. So I kind of see it as my goal of what I'm doing is to be able to give them the tools and the workflows so that they can work with those materials as close to how they work with their paper materials. And that you know, we're trying to break out of the mold of like separating things and saying, oh, this is our audio, let's put it over here. This is our digital records. These are floppy disks. Put those over here. Give them to that person. So a large part of what we're trying to do is to be able to kind of bring a kind of holistic approach where, you know, the tools are in place so that they can make those descriptions and do the appraisal. So right now, you know, before we image things, we might take, a floppy disk and put it into an FC5025, which is a floppy controller that you're not really doing kind of a preservation level capture, but where somebody could see what kind of files are on there, or even take a look at them and do an initial appraisal of whether or not this is worth keeping or not, because we definitely, you know, you definitely find complete junk in your collections. And then where I and my assistant come in is that we kind of deal with the technical part of doing the imaging, ensuring the preservation steps have been taken, and getting those things loaded up and into FDK where the archivist can work with it. And then after that, once they've done an arrangement, we kind of deal with the technical part of, okay, now what do we do? How do we make this accessible? How do we get this to researchers? What are we dealing with here? So, I mean, I guess we're just trying to kind of take the really technical part out of the picture and then let the rest of the process go on as it were, you know, as the regular course of how we deal with collections.
So what is imaging?
Making an image is making a perfect byte for byte transfer of another digital bit stream. So in the case, like when we talk about digital forensics with floppy disks, we're both Mark and I work with a device called a CryoFlux, where we're actually recording the flux transitions off the disk and preserving them, but then interpreting that into a byte sector image that can work with a computer. Excuse me. It's taking a piece of media and trying to capture a perfect representation of the bytes that are on that disk.
Is that like a flux capacitor at all?
Kind of like a flux capacitor.
What format do I save my image in? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I think where I work at this point, the work is a little bit less integrated than it is at NYPL. I think it's very similar. I think, you know, my responsibility has really been in terms of doing a lot of infrastructure development, at least so far. My supervisor and I, and now the Gabby Redwine, who's the digital archivist at the Beinecke, the three of us, and a very, very small handful of others, do a lot of that, have been doing the majority of that work. At Yale, you know, doing things like developing the requirements for our forensics lab and, you know, essentially picking out the equipment, doing some of the setup, developing the workflows. One of the projects I'm working on is helping with a Archivematica implementation project at Yale. So doing things like developing requirements and working with software developers. I know there is definitely interest in integrating things a bit more at Yale. It's just, I think we're, in my department in particular, we're faced with a couple of challenges in terms of how processing priorities get established. So I think, you know, realistically, you know, we've got some obligations that the department has to fulfill before, you know, realistically, I think some of this workflow ends up getting a little bit more integrated. For some of the staff involved at Yale, there are a couple of staff members who have done disk imaging already. We had a student working for us for several months who was doing a lot of disk imaging for us. A couple of the archivists who are not digital archivists have also started doing some disk imaging. We've done a little bit of processing in FDK, but we haven't done much, again, because basically what our processing priorities are right now. I think we are a little bit further off in some ways than NYPL is, but I hope we'll be getting closer. but, you know, I think really what you know, what I see is, you know, I think similarly, I see my role as sort of probably sort of the same way that Don does, is, you know, my job really makes a lot of the other work possible. So it's a lot of sort of, you know, there's definitely a hands-on aspect, but really, I think one of the challenges that I've had at Yale is, my responsibility has been less directly, you know, involved with the processing of the material. It's sort of, you know, and because of that, it's a lot of this material sort of is still waiting to be processed. You know, it's been harder to sort of convince, some of my colleagues that this stuff is a priority, which I totally understand.
Yeah, and building on that, it'd be interesting, I guess, to hear both of your thoughts about either stuff you're working on as far as access. I mean, certainly getting stuff off of legacy media is very challenging, but, I mean, serving it up is even probably more challenging. A lot of the tools aren't necessarily there. There's lots of access restrictions as well. So I guess thoughts about either stuff you're working on or stuff that's going on in the field as far as serving up born digital material to patrons or researchers?
Yeah, that's like everything else. That's difficult. I can say that's really difficult. Yeah, it is difficult.
Our next question is going to be what's really easy.
What's really easy? Well, I guess what is really easy is most places, most repositories that are dealing with this is to get a file viewer and a workstation set up in your reading room where you can actually try to provide access to these materials. So I know both of our repositories use a product, QuickView, which is a kind of a general file reader. So that is easy to set up and use, but then to, like you bring up, to bring all those, the policies or the governance or whatever you want to call it, to actually have those materials readily available and how you transfer those to the reader are really complicated. You know, like a collection that we're about to open up has email in it, and fairly modern email that there's no difference to that than the correspondence that's also in the collection. But, you know, we can't just leave that in a computer in the reading room that somebody could get on. So there's a whole level of security and trying to ensure that we're being, you know, as careful as possible and you know, restricting the material and that it's only getting to the readers that we know that are using it responsibly. Yeah, that's been a, I don't want to call it daunting, but it's a lot of work we've put into doing that. And so the model that we're using is basically, as we describe components in a finding aids and we list boxes, we also list components of electronic records. And if somebody comes in and is working with a finding aid and sees that, like, our archivists or our reference archivists or reference staff need to be able to page those materials from a secure location, just like they would be able to page the physical materials from the stacks. That requires a whole set of technologies and policies, and we don't necessarily in the library have the infrastructure to do that all through one sort of centrally managed place. If you get down to that, where you're trying to retrieve single files for readers on demand, it's, you know, like the possibilities are kind of endless. That's been our goal, is to give the tools so that we can, you know, move these packages and materials from a secure location to a somewhat less secure location that a reader can try to use a file viewer. And we can't guarantee that they're going to be able to read every file, but we're trying our best to make those, you know, using the forensic tools, you can get an idea of what is going to render and what isn't. The question of how authentic it is being used through the file viewer is another problem, but it's, you know, I think we're giving that the starting point for the researcher to work with, and then after that it may become, you know, a more in-depth research project that they need to bring their own tools and techniques to deal with, but we're not quite there yet. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we're certainly not as far along as where I'd like to be, but you know, it doesn't mean that I haven't been thinking about it. So, I mean, there's one idea which I've certainly talked about with Don quite a bit, which is providing some sort of the thing that I think archivists really tend to be worried about are this, you know, dealing with the potential for remote access for this, with these materials, and providing some sort of secure remote access. I think we're really used to some sort of, like, a traditional digital collections paradigm, which is there's some sort of site that you go to, you can view things at an item level, you know, which, first of all, obviously that's not going to work for this stuff. I think one of the parts of the problem is that we're already struggling with how to best describe this material, you know, sort of what level of aggregation is actually appropriate for something like a finding aid. Obviously, you know, we're not going to describe things at a file level, you know, if that's, there's not really, you know, that's not necessarily useful. So I think, you know, in the same way, we need to think about access, at sort of a higher level of aggregation. You know, we need to be better about understanding what, you know, if we say that material is restricted for 30 years or whatever, what are the, you know, how do we structure the material in our systems to make that, you know, to honor those restrictions? It's not impossible, but it requires some really tough decisions. You know, I think our infrastructure needs to match our policy a little bit better, and that's not really something that I think many places are doing well yet. But I think there's a lot of hope for something which is like essentially like an authenticated remote desktop environment where, you know, we provide access to a limited subset of records. So, you know, we could transfer files into or out of a particular network space, and then have that that virtual machine essentially have access to a certain section of materials. At the same time, one of the advantages that I've been thinking about that for us is the issue with using something like QuickView is, you know, it's commercial software. It's, you know, we're bound to obey the license terms. We can't, you know, give people copies of that software to use on their own machines. But in a remote desktop environment, you know, we can, you know, if we have a certain number of virtual machines or a certain number of connections, we can more easily calculate the licensing costs. You know, we could have, you know, X number of simultaneous users and pay for that. It's really interesting for us at Yale in particular, because my repository, you know, we've got a lot of architectural records. So we've got, you know, lots of, you know, files from lots of different versions of AutoCAD, which, you know, right now we can't provide any reasonable access to. We don't have any versions of AutoCAD which we can install on a machine. But, you know, one possibility would be to essentially have this, you know, lockdown infrastructure where, you know, somebody could access, you know, AutoCAD 12. You know, we have the license for it. You know, it's, you know, we have five virtual machines which have AutoCAD 12 installed. You know, that's the way that we provide access. And, you know, I think there's a lot of potential, you know, to look at, you know, for example, what, you know, what social science research has, you know, the sort of data archives for social science have figured out a lot of interesting solutions to this problem. And I think it really makes sense to look at those.
Don, you mentioned researchers bringing their own tools to access stuff, and this is an interesting question to me of thinking about what seems a little bit of a shift in a way about providing access, of putting this responsibility on the researchers to, and you can provide them the image and or something, and then they have to figure out how to open it, or
I don't know if that's necessarily a new idea. I mean, it's always working with the curatorial or the research staff if what we have in a reading room isn't good enough to, you know, work, you know, do research, whether that means sending something off for, you know, high-res scanning or, I don't have a great example off the top of my head, but I think everything's always sort of a, working with the repository to figure out how we can best, I mean, ultimately, we want good research and we want new knowledge about our assets. So, yeah, and I think, like, if there is that research or that would, you know, that has their own set of tools, that if we can come to an agreement that where we can provide them with those disk images in the end, that's a good thing. You know, but like anything else, we have to make sure that they're going to be responsible for the material. So that's where it comes down to, you know, having whoever's curatorial responsible for these materials to be able to make those decisions. But I'm definitely not against the idea.
I mean, we don't translate materials that are in another language for patrons, you know, mm-hmm. necessarily. I mean, you know, if it's a documentary editing project, then maybe you might do that. But, you know, for something that's in archives, you make an assumption that, somebody who wants to work with these materials can read them. But, you know, that's obviously we're still at the sort of point of transition where we don't really know necessarily what it means or what is a realistic skill set for the researcher to have. I mean, obviously it's in our interest to get these materials used, so we don't want to set too high of a barrier. But obviously we can't provide an ideal level of access. Without, you know, significantly more resources and having better policy. I think the policy is much more achievable in the near term than the resources.
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess, you know, oh, you have interesting things. Can you email that to me? Like, that's not what we're talking about. I think it's going to be an interesting going forward how research happens, especially, like, if we get to the point where we're having these virtualized environments for people to work in. I mean, ultimately, I think that's probably where the answer is going to be, is that we have, you know, these virtualized setups that people can use, or even potentially, you know, upload their own tools to. We'll have to see.
I see the translation analogy. I know it makes sense, but I also see it from a technology gap kind of thing. You know, for a film, we wouldn't expect a researcher to bring in a 16mm projector to watch a film. There would be some kind of access copy, you know, service copy, something made for that. Whether that's already been made or whether they come in and make the request and that reformatting is done for them. I don't know what the answer is here. I think it's just an interesting thing that there's, you know, there's this gap now of, like, can people work with this technology who want to research it, you know, or the content of it.
And I think part of the problem is that, you know, as it's, you know, it's not exactly easy to admit this, but sometimes we don't even understand the content of what we have in our own collections. I mean, that's really the problem with this is, you know, if we get something, in Don's talking about this multimate format, you know.
Advanced multimate.
Yeah.
Well, not regular multimate.
Yeah. Advanced multimate. Well, precisely. It's advanced multimate. That's part of the problem. If potentially, you know, if we can tell somebody what sort of file format that is, you know, sort of what is our level of responsibility? I mean, mm-hmm. do we license this? Do we say, you know, really, we can tell you what file format it's in, then it's still your responsibility to figure out how to read it, you know. Mm-hmm. Just again, it's this problem of, you know, we were not thinking about these problems when we brought it in, and I see there is an analogy to thinking about something like, you know, moving image material, but it's still, you know, moving image material is still going to be intelligible by, you know, to some extent as long as we have the means to reproduce it. But we don't necessarily know what the means to reproduce that material are, because we don't know we don't know which software application was used to create the file, which current applications can not even accurately render, but render the file at all. I think we're working at a pretty strong disadvantage. I certainly don't want to vilify past decision making, but, you know, these were decisions that were not, you know, not necessarily thought through, and, you know, because the community was not, you know, we didn't have the same abundance of file formats, or we were not, that was not a concern when this material was brought in. So.
And also the rate of change that's been going on for consumer products for, you know, desktop editing. It changes so fast that it's hard to keep a handle on those. I was at an Open Planets Foundation event a couple months ago where I saw a demonstration of a virtualized environment where they're able to bring up specific operating systems and then have specific software on those operating systems. And the idea of that, if you have the right metadata about your files, that if a user wanted to use it, then according to the metadata, you would just then need to fire up the correct virtual machine with the correct operating system. And that sounds great, but I don't know, given the kind of collections that we're working with, like as Mark says, where you don't have a lot of control over the content as it's coming in or the file formats, where that metadata comes from. The forensic tools help, but then we probably don't even want to get into discussing file format identification and false identification and so forth, because everything becomes really difficult really quickly. So, I mean, thinking forward, that would be great if we had those types of environments. Just given the materials, though, I'm not sure how we get to that point.
Mm-hmm. It's difficult. Yeah.
Well, one interesting theme that I think has come out over the conversation is like working with other communities outside of the archival world. I mean, I know the criminal forensics has obviously provided a lot of the technologies for forensics. You mentioned working with like social science, data archiving, data curation, whatever. It seems like it's more important in this realm than it was in traditional, you know, processing or archival workflows and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I guess I know you guys have had some engagement with those communities. Do you see a lot of potential there for continued collaboration and tool development and that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, I know Mark probably will have the same feeling. As like we generally those are you know, the products and the development behind those dual tools are driven by a market that exists for those, and I don't think we've really established a marketplace for digital forensics in archives, so we're kind of left, I know, as the bottom feeders, I guess, trying to...
I don't even know if we've established a marketplace for digital preservation. I take that a step further, and it's sort of, you either need to look towards industry or you need to look towards research and development. And I think, you know, I think there's a potential to collaborate with researchers in particular. But the thing to remember is that researchers are only going to be interested in to the extent that it fits within their research. I think this is a challenge that I know that Don and I have both faced with some of the open source forensic tools, is that, you know, they're open source, they're great, but, you know, they're the part of the problem. Well, one of the challenges, let me rephrase that, is one of the challenges is that, you know, some of these tools are used by forensics researchers, you know, people who are, you know, teaching graduate computer science and are doing, you know, may have been involved in forensic investigations, but see this as a domain of, you know, of research in computer science. To the extent that the fact that we've been able to use their tools, sometimes we use their tools in ways that were not intended. And I think it's, you know, it's hard to sort of, maybe not even expect a level of support, but sort of, you know, have a level of engagement which really, allows them to understand where we're coming from and sort of to value, you know, I don't think that everybody should value our work, you know, I mean, it's, but, you know, I do think that it can be a hard sell to somebody who's, you know, and it's a different hard sell than it is trying to get, you know, enterprise IT to buy into what we're doing. I think the potential is there, but, you know, really it needs to be, you know, it, you, we we need to figure out a better way to push this. And I think there are some there are some examples of some very good long-term collaborations between, you know, archives and computer science researchers. It's just, you know, there are very, very, very few of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the marketplace issue is very much, there is no marketplace. Archives are too small a piece of the pie to make, mm-hmm. make people want to make stuff for them. we weren't going to keep Kodak afloat by reformatting film. It's not a big enough of a thing to support a corporation like that. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely an issue there, and that we do need to, you know, collaborate and look towards these things of developing, you know, identifying our needs and moving ahead and developing it and doing that. So it's a really important issue. So do you think that library science and archives programs are preparing people for this?
Nice question, Josh.
Because, you know,
why just get them in trouble?
Yes, well, this is what we're facing. I mean, you know, it's, you know, you guys have a certain skill set. You know, there's a growing amount of people working on this. You know, are people being prepared for this, though, within the educational programs that are out there?
I think there are some programs that are, but I don't think all of them are. I mean, I think really, I think part of the issue is convincing students that they want to be interested in this and they really do need to know this. I know that there are some programs. The really obvious one to me is UNC. But, you know, I know there are others that are really, I know that, you know, University of Illinois to some extent, there are some programs that are really teaching these skills, but even if there are classes, it's more of a marketing problem, I think, than, you know, a lot of this stuff, it can be hard to teach this stuff in a classroom setting. But I think it's really, there's a level of responsibility has to, you know, it, certainly not every program has classes where students will be able to learn this, but it really is, I think, up to the student in some way, but also up to the faculty advisors to really, you know, push students in this direction.
Yeah, and I can say that we've done interviews with, you know, archivists that are just coming out of library programs, and they're able to talk about the problem or understand it. So I think it's things like, you know, the Wire blog or wherever that the message is getting out there. I can't comment on programs per se. It's been a long time since I was in library school. But yeah, it seems like generally I find people are understanding or have an understanding of what the types of problems that they're going to deal with in terms of processing collections. So, I mean, I guess it's getting better.
I think building on that point, a similar thing that would be interesting to hear your thoughts on and doesn't have to refer to your specific roles is sort of the place of like the quote unquote digital archivist as like a change agent within a specific institution. I saw a good presentation on this the other day, and it just noted the sort of that there's sometimes more, I won't call it like pressure or responsibility necessarily, but there's a sort of expectation of people to come in and solve a lot of problems without being integrated into the fuller archival, you know, enterprise within their institution. And that, you know, poses both career challenges and continuing education challenges and, you know, can even have difficulty as far as, you know, making that argument within programs to actually convince more students to do it. So, you know, I don't have any expectations of what you should say to this, but, you know, do you see it being sort of something that newly hired digital archivist in a program that didn't necessarily formally have this position, like challenging in the community or in some institutions?
Yeah, I mean, like right now, and maybe we're getting out of this phase, but generally the digital archivist, the job description would be a catch-all for someone that has a bunch of different varied technical skills, and then we'll put you to use as best as possible. I mean, I think going beyond that, the idea of having a digital archivist who's processing the materials and that they're being separated and going through a completely separate workflow, or like, I don't think that works, and that you're actually weakening your ability to control those materials through time. So yeah, I would agree with you that I think that the digital archivist should be there to hopefully facilitate change to workflows that help the long-term management of these materials, whether that's working with the preservation people or, getting these tools ready or even writing scripts or whatever to deal with small problems I really kind of feel like the digital archivist should be that kind of facilitator.
I really hate the job title digital archivist. if you know me, you've probably heard me complain about that. This is something I really struggle with. I do think for a newly created digital archivist position, that person really does need to be a change agent, but that assumes that there is an institutional commitment for that change, which is part of the challenge that I know that I've run into, and a lot of my other colleagues have run into, is that the institution at some level is convinced that they need a digital archivist, presumably because they have lots of boxes with lots of disks in them, but that's not a commitment to change. I mean, the commitment to change is really to not, segregate these materials and I think, focus on better collaboration with IT or whatever. There absolutely needs to be an institutional commitment and support for, that role to do that. And in part, that's why I really don't like the job title digital archivist, because, it's still, effectively isolating the work of that person. I understand why, it may be different from it may be different from what most archivists do in a given institution, but it's still, it needs to be, management and administration really need to understand how this work does end up getting integrated. Otherwise, I think we end up facing the same set of challenges over and over and over again. But I mean, digital archivist is I think a very poor label for the type of work that we do. I mean, there are some days where I'd rather just be called an archivist. There are some days where I'd rather just be acknowledged that I'm a systems architect and maybe I'm not doing lots of the hands-on work itself. There are days where it's sort of, I think part of the problem is that, there is no good way for a lot of repositories to acknowledge this work, which is somehow understood to be distinct and additional from, sort of the work of accessioning or appraising, processing and, providing reference service to collections. This work, the work that we're doing obviously supports that, but it's, if you're not directly fulfilling an archival function, then you should not be called an archivist.
Right. I definitely see that in that hiring, if you're being hired as the first digital archivist or whatever role that is, that means there's no policies there in place already. There's no infrastructure for it. So probably the first couple of years of your job is creating those policies and talking to people, making them know who you are and getting the support and figuring out what to do. And so, it's a lot of talking to people and advocacy for the role. And but it's collection management stuff. Mm-hmm. It just happens to be with a different type of thing, but it really comes down to different aspects of collection management. So it's, dividing it like that is problematic in that way.
I want to know when we're going to hire the last analog archivist. That is a job title somewhere. I don't remember.
Really? I've never seen that one.
It's at like the National Snow and Ice Data Center or something.
Everything's ephemeral at the Snow and Ice Data Center.
Well, maybe not if it's really cold.
True.
That's true. Well, global warming.
All right. Oh, that.
Oh, wait, we just lost our funding now. So.
That'll be edited out later.
So, to bring things back to where we started, another question here, maybe a final question to wrap up. Unless you guys just want to keep talking, then we can go and you can talk. It's fine. But who represents Florida better, Don Johnson or David Caruso?
Oh, Don Johnson, obviously.
Yeah.
I'd have to agree.
Okay. So Miami centric.
Something about the red hair of Caruso, it's just not trustable. Okay. Just don't trust that guy. Cool. Well, thanks a lot, guys.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.